That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded April 2018. Episode number 23, It's Not Easy Being Blue.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent and, let's face it, irrelevant look at some of the highest grossing movies of the last 80 odd years. This time round, we have been watching James Cameron's Avatar from 2009. A film that was praised for its technical abilities and technical prowess, but maybe not for its enjoyable story. So, joining me as always on this adventure in film, I am delighted to say I am joined by Daisy Swaffer.
Hello.
Joe Carter.
Hello.
And as always, my darling wife, Sammy Kelch.
Hello, I guess.
Avatar, yes. One of the first, well, not necessarily the first, but one of the most successful 3D films of the current age. In fact, probably the first big successful 3D film. And in many ways, I suspect that was what fueled its success, is the fact that it was in 3D and it was new. Because, as I sort of alluded to earlier, story-wise, But let's get everybody's opening thoughts on this film. Let's start with Sammy.
Okay. Well, first things first, I think the reason that most people did go see it was the fact that it was 3D, because it doesn't really have a lot of other things going for it. And I'm restraining myself in saying it as gently as that.
It is a film that certainly has some quite clunky dialogue all the way through it. Joe, your opening thoughts?
Well, I originally went to see it in 3D, and as someone who suffers from motion sickness, did not really enjoy it that much. And I think that had coloured my remembering of it, because when I watched it this time, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And dare I say, it was vaguely enjoyable. Not to say that it wasn't really problematic and I was getting very angry at the characters, but it was kind of pretty.
Yes, I don't think anybody can deny the fact that it is very pretty. And Daisy, your opening thoughts?
When I saw this at the cinema way back in 2009, I was, like many of the audiences, wowed by the 3D. Unfortunately, watching it at home on the TV, in order to make the 3D effective, it means that they're constantly moving the camera. Even when it's, you're just looking at a group of people who are just talking, the camera is still constantly moving so that you get that depth perception when you're watching it in 3D. So all that did was make me feel motion sick the entire time watching it at home, not in 3D. And I never really paid much attention to the plot when I watched it at the cinema because I was too busy going ooh and ah at the 3D, which I think if you could quite happily cut out about 30 to 40 minutes of this that's just there in order to show off the 3D. It does nothing for the plot or nothing for the world building or anything. And if I had to say anything about the plot, I'd say that if I was writing a story that was the archetypal white saviour complex, it would be this film.
Yeah. So you had the opposite reaction to what I did with the motion sickness.
Yeah,
thing.
I got really the motion sickness at home and you got it in the cinema.
See, when I went to see this in the cinema, I wasn't sure whether it was just the 3D giving me the motion sickness or the fact that I made the very conscious decision to go into the movie having consumed an entire bottle of Kahlua before doing so, because I had no confidence in enjoying this film apart from, oh, the 3D is nifty.
Dave, your opening thoughts.
My opening thoughts, I didn't see this at the cinema. I have not enjoyed it, or not enjoyed it, if the case being, in 3D. I only have ever seen this on home screens.
On home movie?
This is the second James Cameron film that we've seen, the first one being Titanic, that was too long, too clunky, and I have no idea why was on this list.
Older listeners, sorry, sweetheart, older listeners may remember that, in fact, poor David had to rage quit partway through Titanic and then come back to it later because it made him that angry.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't rage quit through this was A, we watched it too late in the day to come back to it the next time. B, I wasn't paying as much attention.
We did have to pause it at least one point for me to just rage about it. But I was committed to getting through it on the day.
The only way I made it through this was by constantly pausing it, and I never normally have to do that. So it took me 4 hours to watch this 2.5 hours.
Oh, honey. I'm sorry.
I mean, as a film, it is very long anyway. Yeah. So, you know, and as we said, we could potentially cut at least 40 minutes out just to get all of the 3D mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah,
out
there
of
was
way.
Just so much that was like, oh, and now there is something sweeping through the undergrowth, and we'll watch that for the next 5 minutes. And it just throughout the film, so many things were, well, this is there just to show off the 3D. And I just wish they'd done a second cut of it that was, oh, hey, you're not watching in 3D. Then watch this much tighter version where none of it is about the 3D effect.
Although I'm assuming the 3D cost a lot of money, so they wanted to put it up on screen.
Yeah.
But they weren't really thinking about the video Blu-ray digital audience with that.
Possibly not, no. Okay, so let's dive into this interesting film. So, opening scene, we get a sort of green, lush world. Intercut with this, and with very cliched voiceovers, we see Jake Sully, who is played by Sam Worthington.
And is not a ginormous, furry, turquoise monster.
Yeah, not that kind
no,
of Sully.
No, not that Sully.
I was very sad about that. Yeah.
I would have much rather watched that movie.
I don't know what else Sam Worthington has done apart from this, and I think he was in the terrible remake of Clash of the Titans.
I think you're right about that.
You might know him from Terminator Salvation, Clash of the Titans, and Man on a Ledge.
No.
So that's what IMDb says his biggest movies other than Avatar are, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, Sam Worthington playing Jake Sully, who is a wheelchair-bound former Marine. He wakes up in a giant spaceship on its way to Pandora, a lush Earth-like moon orbiting the planet of Polyphemus.
Yes, lush Earth-like, except that humans cannot breathe on it and therefore should have probably taken that as a clue.
I may have murdered the name of the actual planet it's orbiting, but it's not real, so who cares? He is one of a large number of passengers all waking up after almost 6 years of cryo sleep. Whilst en route to Pandora. So that's 6 years they've been in this thing making its way there. It's 4.3 light years, so they're not even getting close to the speed of light. I mean, this is just terrible technology. So yeah, he wakes up, he's in this zero-G environment, and he makes his way to a locker, which is actually marked Sully T, not Sully G. We then get through voiceover, flashbacks of hospital, military officials. We learn that actually Jake has a deceased brother, Tom, who was a scientist who was actually supposed to be part of this program. But Jake was given the opportunity to take over his brother's contract because he was genetically the same as his brother.
Crucially, a twin brother.
They were
brother,
twins.
Yeah.
Twin
identical
brother.
Identical twin.
and so this would mean that he would still be valid for the Avatar program.
Even though he is a self-professed dumb grunt.
Yep.
A beautiful sigh.
They're transported from the main ship to Pandora Virus Shuttle. Jake is one of many soldiers and civilian personnel about to touch downs. We catch a view of the base, its construction, an immense mining machine digging up the soil, and a large quarry that just goes to basically start the hammering over the head of the ecological message.
Yeah, there's nothing subtle about the message of this movie.
Yeah,
nothing.
Yeah.
It's...
We find out that all people are supposed to wear full-face breathing masks since the atmosphere of the planet will not support human life. Apparently 20 seconds of exposure to the atmosphere will cause unconsciousness, with death occurring about four minutes later.
They really should have taken
that as
a hint.
So that's something fun.
Maybe this isn't a great planet for you to visit on this kind of scale. Never mind.
Once landed, Jake goes to a military briefing where Colonel Miles Quaritch...
Well, we get the reveal of the fact that he's in a wheelchair as well.
Ah, yes, that's true. Actually, we don't see him in a wheelchair until they land, because obviously before that they're in zero-G, so the use of the legs is less of an obvious sign.
Because he got a hole blown in his spine during whatever war he was being forced to fight.
And the other soldier people are already... being derogatory about him as a result of his disability because that's
meals on wheels.
I'm so sorry, but what do people actually do this?
Well, this is the thing about this film that was one of the many things that annoy me about this film is that The people on this planet, or this moon rather, are all private contractual security forces. So all the people there are ex-Marines and ex-military, but none of them behave like ex-Marines or ex-military. They all behave like a bunch of thugs.
And the thing is, if you're ex-military, I guarantee that you know many people who have disabilities because they've been injured on the job in the military, which is a very dangerous profession. So you wouldn't be like, disability joke, Mr. Wheelchair Boy, because chances are, you know, like, you know several people who have some kind of disability because of the work that they did. So that...
But what you're forgetting here is that one of the messages of this film is that disability is a bad thing and we should cure it by any means necessary.
Yeah, that was going to be my point, and I was really, really angry.
Great ham-fisted beginning of the entire ableist narrative of this story, which is so offensive.
They're hammering home that disability is not something that is an acceptable thing for anybody to have by making sure he's bullied immediately by people who, you know, in any kind of logical sense would not be doing that.
Well, I mean, he's already basically going on what he considers to be a suicide mission because he thinks he's got nothing to live for. I mean, okay, yes, his brother has been killed. That's
because disabled always means you have nothing to live for.
Being in a wheelchair.
This was one of my biggest problems with this film, was their treatment of disability.
It's so offensive.
Bearing in mind, his brother died because of a mugging. His brother didn't even die anything other than just a standard sort of... Was it knife to death because of what was in his wallet?
Yeah,
or something
he was, you know, mugged in some whatever civilian setting.
Convenience store robbery or whatever. It was trivial. It was basically a plot point to go, oh, well, he's not a scientist, but oh, he happened to have an identical twin brother who was a scientist. And oh, has he need something to do because he realizes he has got nothing to live for?
Please.
Let's let him take his brother's place on this weird science trip thing where he has literally zero training and zero... I really empathise with Sigourney Weaver on this point. It's like...
Yeah. And they say that it's because it's so expensive to make one of these avatars that they couldn't... And it's like, no, really, if you go to the expense of making one of these, then you do it for someone who's actually trained in it. And
he's been
on that ship for 6 years. In the meantime, you could have made another one for someone who
is trained. You could have figured out a way to re-engineer whatever you've got.
That's the other thing, is they're on the ship for 6 years. That's 6 years where he doesn't have to be asleep all that time. He could be having lessons and training and I don't
they
know what
have, like,
to actually prepare him.
They taught him Navi, is it Navi?
They could have easily woken him up at any time during that 6 years and
like,
given him the training
here's
he needed
the briefing,
to be.
Yeah. Right? But no, nothing. That makes no sense.
He turns up and he knows absolutely nothing. He's not had any kind of information about this trip at all, which is also absurd.
Jake lands and goes immediately to a military briefing where Colonel Miles Quaritch, which is apparently a gentleman called Stephen Lang, never heard of him before, only ever seen him in this film, is there addressing the assembled soldiers and civilians. He reminds them that they are not in Kansas anymore, which is cliched.
Oh, God, the dialogue is just painful. Nobody talks like this at, like, briefings and whatever. They never do, and they always do in films, and I hate it.
So he tells them about Pandora's indigenous population, the Navi. He says that they're hard to kill, and practically everything out there will try and kill you. Because, well, it's not your planet, so, you know.
Yeah, I wrote in my notes here.
Again, take the hint.
I wrote in my notes, this place is hell, everything wants to eat you. Got it.
Yep.
Yeah. He says it's his job to keep Obi alive, but he will not manage to keep everybody alive. Which, again...
Why would you sign up for this?
Because there's a mineral called an Uptanium.
Which is a great name for a mineral.
Oh, yeah, that is just
ridiculous.
It's on the planet, and so the whole motivation is money and greed, and that part I can buy.
Yeah,
it's all corporate.
They have something we want, so we're going to kill them to get it.
Yeah.
Yep. Jake then goes on to the science lab where he meets biologist Norm Spellman and Dr. Max Patel.
Yes, I love him in Bones, and I loved him in this.
Who are two members of the Avatar program. Jake gets his first look at his own Avatar, which looks like him, but blue, tall, and...
I didn't think it looked that much like him.
It looked like his brother.
No. They're identical, but... So, yes, this is the thing. The whole point of this film is that you can somehow mind link with this avatar and then control the
transfer
avatar.
Transfer your consciousness.
Transfer your consciousness. Does this mean that when you're not in the avatar is just a sack of meat?
Yeah.
But again, it doesn't make any sense.
It's a terrible, stupid idea. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. That part, you just have to get past at this point in the film. You just have to go, it doesn't make any sense, but I just have to go with it.
Yeah, the human has to go in this pod thing and be connected up to wires, yet the avatar, no wires.
No, it's just out there. Yeah, so if you have to come out of it in an emergency, you just sort of flop to the ground, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the point being that in this avatar body, Jake will be able to walk around, breathe the air, and interact with the natives.
Because it's a hybrid human Navi.
It is, yes, because that's the other thing, is they have eyebrows and five fingers and toes, which the Navi don't.
I totally didn't even notice that. I just thought it was weird they were wearing human clothes that had somehow been stretched. And trainers.
Some like team of, I don't know, like seamstresses and cobblers had to make giant clothes and shoes to fit these Navi bodies.
Because they're like, what, 8 to 10 foot or something?
They are taller by a significant margin than the human people, by a good, 3 feet, probably.
So they all go into the science area, and at this point, Dr. Grace Augustine, played by Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney!
Who is the program science lead, awakens from the pod that links her to her avatar.
The best thing about this movie was Sigourney Weaver. I have a fun fact here. You see how she's smoking a cigarette there?
Yes.
I like the way you say that as though we're watching it on the screen right now. That's the smoke from that cigarette is all computer generated.
Is that so it can be 3D smoke?
Quite possibly.
I have no idea why, whether it's because Sigourney Weaver did not want to smoke a cigarette or because they wanted it
quite
to
possibly
be 3D smoke.
Fair enough.
But it is computer generated
maybe
smoke.
They just thought that it read better on screen than real smoke.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, real smoke tends to look disappointing sometimes.
Yeah.
Augustine wakes up and speaks to Norm in Navi, which is the language of the natives, and then turns to Jake and basically tells him that she doesn't want him. His brother was a PhD who trained for 3 years for this mission, and he's just a grunt.
Which is a valid complaint.
Which, yes, completely valid point.
I mean, you know, it's not the politest way of putting it, because it's not 100% his fault that he received zero training on this, but it's a valid complaint.
Yeah.
Can I use this point to interject with a fun fact about the Navi language?
Yes, of course.
It was created entirely from scratch for this movie. Or as it will now be for this franchise of movies, by a linguist called Dr. Paul R. Fromer. And so the idea was to make a language that the actors could pronounce easily, but didn't actually sound like a particular language that we have here on Earth.
Smart.
And he made about 1,000 different words for this language. And Sam Worthington, our actor playing Jake Sully, said that he found it easier to master the Navi language than the American accent.
Which surprises me not at all.
Sam Worthington being Australian,
demonstrably Australian in this film. With apologies, Mr. Worthington, but I could totally tell that he was Australian.
Born in England, and then he moved to Australia when he was 6 months old.
Grace storms off to the base's control room to confront Parker Selfridge, played by Giovanni Ribisi, who I know from... I was going to say Fast and Furious, but I don't mean Fast and Furious. The one with Nick Cage and the cars.
I don't know, but he played Phoebe's brother on Friends.
Gone in 60 Seconds.
Gone in 60 Seconds, that's the one. Thank you, Joe.
I remember him from Friends, thank you. But he's really, really, really annoying in this movie. I hate his character so much. I want to punch
his character
him
was very repulsive
in his face.
But that's kind of that was the character they were going for.
Oh, I know, but I still wanted to punch him in his face.
So yes, Grace storms off to confront Parker Selfridge, who is base commander and representative for the Resources Development Administration, which is an organization that oversees all military and other personnel on the colony. You know, when it's called Resources Development Administration, you know basically it's a land grab, isn't
it?
Yeah. He was basically a suit. He didn't seem military at all.
He tells her Jake will serve as a security escort on her team whilst they're on the planet's surface. Grace doubts that Jake would be any use to her botanical research.
And we all agree as
that's
the audience.
That's fair, yeah.
But that's not why the captain wants him there.
Since he is a perfect genetic match for the avatar intended for his twin brother, and are identical twins actually genetically identical?
Yes.
Yeah, they
are. Okay.
Fingerprints
are. Haven't you ever seen like a murder mystery with identical twins and they don't know the...
Yeah, because with DNA evidence, you can't convict either one of them because there's reasonable doubt always because it could
fair
be
enough.
You can if you've got fingerprint evidence because identical twins don't have the same
fingerprint. Yeah, but with DNA evidence and you can't.
So yes, Jake in his military guise will help with their overall objective of the operation, which is, as we said earlier, mining the mineral unobtainium, which is the most stupid name
for
anything.
Honestly, if you're going to make up a name for an element, I mean, come on.
It was basically like an in-joke that I think, because that was like the long-used name as the joke name for anything like that. And didn't they use it in The Core in about 2003?
I just don't understand why it stays in the script.
Which was not exactly your high-quality
movie. Why would that stay in the script? Just come up with, just key smash something and it will sound better and less ham-fisted and fake and stupid, you know?
Unobtainium is your placeholder name for it, and then someone forgot to change it.
Yeah, just control F on the script. You're good. Like, jeez.
So unobtainium apparently is a potential source of energy that sells for millions of dollars for a kilo and can help bring cheap power back to a dying Earth. Although, if it's selling for millions per kilo, I'm not sure how that can be classed as cheap. So yes, that's what they're doing there. They're basically strip mining the planet, ignoring the natives, and destroying the environment to get hold of this mineral that can be used to save a dying Earth. So yeah, not hammering home the environmental message at all. So it's morning, and Jake and Norm are linked to their avatars for the first time.
This bit's funny.
Yeah, Jake wakes up in a different room with other avatars and staff. He's told to keep still because it's his first time ever in an avatar body. But he decides not to. He gets up and starts moving around. He realizes he has sort of a long, whippy tail that he uses to, well, doesn't use, but knocks things over with.
Of course.
So the Na'vi is sort of over 10 feet, probably 12 feet tall and far stronger than humans.
And blue.
And blue.
It's a good point to have a quick fun factoid about the Na'vi.
Go on.
According to James Cameron, that is. They are blue in order to create a conceptual parallel with the Hindu depictions of God, like Vishnu and later avatars, like Krishna and... Yes,
oh my God! Yes.
So that was basically why they're blue, because in Hindu, the avatars of the gods are blue.
Obviously, this is Jake. This is the first time he's been able to walk and move and use his legs in quite some time. So he is enjoying the feeling of running around.
He's been asleep for 6 years.
But he's also not had use of his legs for a long while either.
No,
so
I think it felt like it was fairly. Yeah.
This dude has come from a military background, and then he proves within 30 seconds of being put into a position where he has to follow rules that he cannot follow rules.
Seriously.
And I just wonder if that's how he ended up being a paraplegic.
I think this is one of the first times that I really started shouting. Like, dude, are you this stupid?
If he hadn't come from a military background, then I, you know, I'd be able to buy him being more like a child and running around like this. But the dude has been trained and drilled so hard to follow rules and instructions.
Well, no, he's been trained to follow orders. And the scientists weren't very... If there'd been someone in there who had a more commanding presence, like Sigourney Weaver's character, whose name I've forgotten, Grace, then it probably would have worked.
I don't know, though.
But
he's
because
not
the
a
scientist,
dog, you know? He doesn't need...
Yeah.
Like, if someone who is obviously is more knowledgeable about the thing that's going on than you are is like, okay, you need to sit down, you should probably sit down.
I mean, the bottom line is he's obviously had a lot of medical time with his injuries. So he's been told to sit down by a doctor. He would probably know better to actually ignore them or to not ignore them. And this is the other thing, this film. He gets into this body. He runs around, and within a minute and a half, he's proficient with using this avatar.
Like, I'm sorry, but this...
I don't know what the training was for. What was the training issue? Because apparently he didn't need it. He just instantly became an expert.
The language and culture and
scientific
method or whatever.
For some reason, Grace seems to like him now that he's bounded around and showed the fact that he completely ignores orders and rules and things.
Yeah, that's
which
so endearing.
I don't understand her response there either. Because so far as she's concerned, then he's in charge of this extremely limited and expensive piece of equipment. You'd think that she would want him to do what he's told.
Yeah, but now she's sort of happy to see him and...
And she's like, oh, great, I like him now. Like, what? No?
It makes no sense!
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense.
I hate it so much.
Yeah.
Like, I'm happy to suspend my disbelief with movies, but then they just keep throwing these things at me that make no sense. Mm.
But this dude, this character, spends the entire, so much of the movie just bumbling around and not doing what, you know, doing stupid stuff, and just bumbles his way into, like, saving everything, what, because he's, I don't know,
a white,
white
man.
Because
he's a
dude?
White
man.
Yeah.
What the hell? No! I hate it!
Yeah.
This is what happens, you know. No offense, Dave, but white men, they just sort of stumble around and fall into good fortune.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it works, right?
Everyone.
Everyone else has to work for it and prove themselves 1,000 times over, but no, he just gets things handed to him.
Well, you know, I stumbled into some good fortune. So
well, you have Sammy.
Didn't I, wife? Exactly.
I consider you good fortune, sweetheart.
Good. So, yes, Grace and Jake go into the barracks and he is encouraged to rest, although he's only been up for a few seconds. Before he lies down to sleep, Jake inspects his neural queue, which is a long appendage that looks like a braid of hair. We'll come back to that later. At the end of the queue is a cluster of hidden tendrils. So yes, when the Avatar sleeps, the link is broken and Jake himself awakens and doesn't get a rollicking for ignoring all orders.
I have a fun fact about that ponytail bit.
Yeah?
Grace says to him, don't play with that, you'll go blind.
Yep.
Which is what traditionally gets told to people when they're masturbating.
Yep.
And the ponytail thing is used in the lovemaking with the Na'vi. So little boys in the Na'vi are told not to play with their ponytails because they'll go blind.
I thought it was more of a sort of neural psychic link rather than something.
It was just done as a masturbation joke.
Oh, well, I know it was a masturbation joke. However, because they use it to communicate with the animals and the flying lizard things, as well as when they have that intimate moment in the tree. I felt like it was more of establishing a psychic connection rather than it being sexual at all, even though I know that that was a joke.
None of this is really particularly well explained or makes any real sense, so it's probably not worry too much about it. Later, Jake meets up with Trudy, who is played by Michelle Rodriguez, who is a retired military pilot with whom he'll spend several weeks getting used to his avatar and exploring Pandora.
And she is very cool.
She is very cool, and I love her.
Is.
And she's not in it enough. She's only in it a little bit, and she's very cool.
And Jake will serve as a door gunner on her crew.
She's been in the Fast and Furious. She's Letty in the Fast
and
Furious.
Yes, that's pretty much the only thing she's really done film-wise.
She was in Lost.
Oh my God, that's
for
true.
26 episodes.
Jake reunites with Colonel Quaritch, who is lifting weights. Colonel tells Jake that he's looking at Jake's service record and was impressed with what he accomplished on some of his tours, including one in Venezuela, because there's a lot of backstory here that no one ever mentions or talks about.
I'm assuming he killed lots of people and thus gained the approval of the annoying, evil military man.
The only thing I can assume is because the Earth is, as they've said, the Earth is dying and running out of resources, it's all gone a bit to poop. But they can still afford to put together a 6-year mission to a completely different planet.
Yeah, but that's only because they're going to strike oil.
Yeah. Colonel once again warns Jake about the dangers awaiting him on Pandora. He also states that he believes that the Avatar program is a joke, but it offers an opportunity for a unique reconnaissance mission. If Jake can find out and tell the Colonel what he needs to know about the natives, how to persuade them to move away from the unobtainable ore deposit, or how to hit them hard if they won't, the Colonel will see to it that Jake gets his surgery and to regain the use of his legs. Because, you know, being...
Yeah.
So, aside from the whole treatment of disability here. Ugh. This is the point where things really unravel for me in buying this movie. Yeah. Because so the whole point here is that they want to basically bulldoze the Na'vi out the way, but then this other science program is there to like try to talk the Na'vi into moving themselves. And this has been going on for how long?
Well, I would assume at least 6 years.
Exactly. For more than 6 years, because it was 6 years ago when he got on that transport and his brother had already been training and whatnot and on this program. Really? They would have waited that long before just bulldozering them out the way? I don't think they would have. If they're that desperate for this mineral.
No, absolutely.
Plutonium,
if it was that urgent, then this wouldn't have taken that long. It makes no sense.
I don't buy this entire science program at all.
No, there's no reason for the science to happen other than maybe as a public relations thing. But this is six years distant. They can do what the heck they want. No one's ever going to find out about it.
Yeah.
I have an explanation, or at least what I understood.
Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah, please.
What I'm assuming has happened is that it was originally a science expedition that they'd found this planet and they wanted to study the indigenous species and figure out about this psychic link between all of the nature and the indigenous species and the Na'vi. And the military attaché, or whoever they are, were sent out merely as sort of originally as protection. And then what I'm guessing is that they discovered the mineral deposit, the unobtainium, when they were on their expedition, and the scientists would have reported it back to the corporation that was sponsoring them, because, you know, dutiful reporting all their findings. They went on collecting their biological samples and doing their surveys, and the people with the money back on Dying Earth went, ooh, 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 hey, we can sell this. And thus then it turned into, how do we get the mine out of the way? But because the science, but probably hadn't been as long as the 6 years.
Yep.
Because of the delay in communication and what have
you. Gotta be honest with you, Joe, you've put a lot more thought into this than like the writers and makers of this movie.
The problem with that is that they are all being financed by the same corporation. So the scientists could just be basically told, right, you're out of here. Go somewhere else.
Why would they put that much money into these avatars that cost so much money that they couldn't possibly just get rid of the one that they built for his brother and build one for someone who is trained?
Because they want to send someone military out there specifically because...
No, that wasn't how the characters were. They were like, okay, well, this is the situation. Let's see if we can use the fact that he is a military guy. He wasn't like, oh, right, let's get a military guy then. It wasn't like, this is a good thing.
But that's why they didn't just scrap the body and get another scientist, because they went, ooh, he has a twin brother who is a military person. We really need someone who can, like...
I don't think they communicated that to the people actually at the planet. If that
No.
But I think that Parker, what's his face, may have had sort of that plan, and Colonel, what's his face.
I mean, I think the only reason the scientists are still there.
Yeah.
The scientists are in the dark.
Yeah.
The only reason the scientists are still there is potentially because if they can get the Na'vi to move, then obviously that will save on machinery and people.
Well, exactly.
Because they have said that the Na'vi are hard to kill. But equally,
because of their poison arrows, though, that's like their poison arrows and their carbon fiber bones are the reason why they're hard to kill. And they've got really big machines.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the other thing, is they could quite easily have just moved everybody into orbit and just bombed it from orbit until there was nothing
literally
left.
Yeah. You're coming from another planet. You've got a spaceship.
Far easier ways of depopulating.
But then there wouldn't have been a movie.
And that even gets rid of all the trees there, so they don't have to dig the trees up. They just clear the ground.
Well, maybe they couldn't do that because the unobtainium is like a radioactive element, and if they'd have bombed it, then it would have become inert.
Joe,
and therefore not
Joe, I love you, and you are thinking way harder about this than the writers did, and it doesn't deserve
really
it.
I'm not thinking particularly hard about it at all.
Which I think goes to show how little they thought about it when they wrote this.
Yeah. Off my immense knowledge of sci-fi and fantasy plots from watching way too much TV and reading too many books.
I can't give them the benefit of the doubt that any of this was on their minds when they wrote this pile of garbage. I just can't.
It's that bad. I don't believe that they were thinking right, these things. It sucks, okay? I'm sorry.
So, reeling for this avatar, Jake flies over Pandora's surface in Trudy's gunship, along with Grace, Norm, and the others. The team lands in a forest where Grace and Norm begin to take samples of the flora and make measurements, like good scientists. Jake, once again, fails miserably to follow orders and, distracted by surroundings, wanders into a field of flowers, which are quite tall, but shrink at Jake's touch.
He is so bad at following orders. So
honestly,
bad.
After this
There's
point, you would just be like, okay, you're not doing this anymore because you keep screwing up and we've barely scratched the surface of this project.
Well, maybe they're just...
To be fair, he doesn't get a choice.
At some
which
point,
is also
yeah.
terrible.
To get to the point where you have to tell him to do the opposite of you what you want him to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, it's like,
because he
okay.
just guaranteed will not follow.
Jake,
orders.
What you're going to do on this project is that you're going to run off in the opposite direction to everybody else, get attacked by something. we really want you to touch some things that nobody's supposed
have,
to touch.
Have a pissing match with a giant rhino lizard monster and then, you know, fall into waterfall after being chased by a giant panther thing.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happens now.
Yes, well, there we go. Now we can continue on. So he falls into the waterfall and then blah, 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 splatter, splatter, splatter.
Some 3D probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, Jake gets confronted by a big rhino dinosaur thing.
I have a fun fact.
Go on.
Go on.
This is a one sentence one. All of the animals on Pandora, other than the Na'vi and obviously the aliens, the humans, all of them have 6 limbs.
Oh, okay. That is something I hadn't noticed.
That's cool. Fun fact.
So yes, he's attacked by this, well, he's not attacked, but he's confronted by this large gorilla.
I wrote dinosaur.
Rhinoceros dinosaur yeah. thing. And then he's attacked by this large sort of panther type dinosaur thing. But he manages to run away because he's the best at everything.
Look at how effortlessly good he is at stuff, even though he sucks.
So runs away and then jumps over a waterfall to survive.
The whooping and cackling sounds that were made by the wolf-like creatures there are made by actual real-life hyenas.
Mm-hmm. Which is why they are so terrifying.
Yay!
Yeah. So Jake's crew searches for him, but Trudy says he'll have to return to base since night ops are not allowed. Grace says he won't last the night because, well, he's useless, obviously.
But oh no, wait a minute.
Oh, hang on.
What's going to happen in the other 2 hours of the film?
It's now night and we see Jake dead after
Finally,
being killed by an animal. No, unfortunately
we
not.
We all leave going, wasn't the 3D of him running away from that panther thing quite good?
This is the other thing that I really annoy me about this film is there is no consequence here at all.
Yeah.
If he dies, he just wakes up in the other room.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, they've lost a very expensive piece of equipment, but...
That can be retrieved
there's no
and repaired.
There's no real sort of consequence here.
Yeah.
At all, for any of this. So it's night, and we see Avatar Jake sharpening spears and trying to start a fire. However, at this time, he is being watched from above by a Na'vi, one of the natives of the planet. The Na'vi aims an arrow at Jake and is about to shoot, but decides against it when a small, ethereal, luminescent creature lands on her bow. Later we learn they are very pure spirits, also known as the Seeds of Ever, the Na'vi's all-powerful god.
It looks like a dandelion fluff if it was in a Ghibli movie.
Yep.
It's a cross between a jellyfish and a dandelion fluff.
Yeah.
It's a jellyfish fluff.
Yep.
Jelly fluff.
The archer retreats, but Jake is being stalked by a pack of viper wolves. God, who names these beings?
A 9-year-old child. That's being cruel.
They're the placeholder names that no one ever replaced.
He dips the end of his spear into a combustible pitch-like liquid and lights the end of it to use it as a torch against the viper wolves, who encircle him, teeth bared, jaws gnashing, just wanting to end the movie.
Oh my god.
Cute Na'vi lady.
Oh god.
The animals attack Jake. He fights back, killing some, but he's taken down by others. Then the archer who is observing Jake joins the battle on his side for no apparent reason.
Well, because of the dandelion fluff.
She kills some of the viper wolves and causes the rest to flee. She tenderly puts out the misery some of the whining, wounded animals and says prayers over them. Jake attempts to thank her for helping him fight off the attackers. She meets his thank with scorn, tells him it's all his fault and they did not need to die and that he should go back to where he came from, which is what we were thinking.
Yeah.
Yes, please. Oh my god.
Jake attempts to follow his rescuer up a tree, asking for help and saying he wants to learn. he's repulsed and told to go back, and that the sky people, i.e., you know,
people what come in space,
because sky people is such a
placeholder.
They're so unsophisticated they don't realize who they are.
Technologically unadvanced, so you are sky people. Yeah, it's just.
Yep.
Well, it was more that she was like, well, the sky people don't want to learn. They just want to try and tell us that we're doing everything wrong and push their beliefs on us, which is basically synonymous with all colonization.
Yeah.
And the arrogance of white men.
So more of the dandelion things appear and land on Jake.
Oh my God, of course.
He asks what they are. And she says they are very pure spirits. The fact that he's covered on them makes an impression on his companion.
Wasn't it handy that she speaks English as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Well, yes, though there was a reason for that, because the scientist lady, Grace, did actually start school and was trying to at least share the language, so...
As Jake tries to keep up with his rescuer, Neytiri, played by Zoe Saldana,
who is in
pretty much everything these days.
Zoe Saldana, oh my God, Zoe, awesome. Honey, you're amazing. You deserve better than this movie.
This was one of her first big things, though, so...
And I guess we're grateful that she was in this if it meant that she got to go be in the Star Treks and the Guardians and all of the other stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, she got to be blue and now she gets to be green.
And I love when she's green, because I do enjoy the Guardians of the Galaxy about an infinity times more than this movie, so...
I was just going to say, the one thing that I noticed, which I'm sure was probably intentional, is that majority of, if not all of the actors that played Na'vi characters were people of colour.
Yes.
How can you have a white saviour complex if the people behind the blue characters aren't people who are not white in this world?
I guess.
True.
It's got to be true white saviour complex, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So
as Jake tries to keep with his rescuer, he is felled by a bolo thrown by a patrol of warriors.
Yay.
Their leader is Tsuchite, who is someone called Laz Alonso. No idea who he is. Apparently, this Neytiri is next in line to the throne, and the man that Neytiri is expected to marry, fair enough.
Because she's next in line to the spirit throne, and because, of course, that means that they will be a mated pair. Not sure how much of that is arranged and how much is actually choice.
Yeah, I don't know how much choice she gets in that. Neytiri stops him from harming Jake by telling that there has been a sign from Ever. Tsuchite tells his men to bring him along. Jake is presented to Neytiri's parents, Etukan and Mawat, who are the leaders of the tribe. Jake tells the elders that he is a warrior, a dreamwalker, and his intention is to learn from them.
He's a warrior of the Jarhead clan.
Oh my God.
Oh yes.
This
one of the many
ridiculous cringe
moments in this film. Yep.
Mawat tastes Jake's blood from a wound on his forehead and decrees it is the will of Ever for him to live with the Omati Gaia and for Neytiri, however reluctantly, to be his teacher in their ways and customs. After a ritual gathering, Jake is brought to his bed, a high leaf up in the home tree that encircles him like a cocoon.
Hammock pod.
As he falls asleep, human Jake is revived. Because human Jake was never in any danger. This is not a thing.
When does Jake actually sleep?
Yeah,
he does.
I was asking this as we were watching the movie, because whenever the Avatar thing goes to sleep, Jake wakes up. And when Jake's in the thing, then the Avatar wakes up. Like, it's what is the schedule that this person is on?
He must get some sleep, because they do mention it, that there's a sleep.
Yeah, they do say that he's running. So later on, they're saying he's not eating as much as he should and he's not getting enough rest. I would assume that if he's in the Avatar form, then his body is in a torpor, if nothing else, so it probably sort of recovers a bit then. So
he certainly can't be getting much sleep, because I don't think they sleep, you know, a particularly long amount in the Na'vi tribe, and that's the only time he's awake as a human. Like, that's the time he needs to be asleep, and yet he's awake and doing things as a human then. So
I think the thing that sort of stood out to me is as the film progresses, his human body gets progressively more and more sort of wasted.
Yeah.
You know, he's visibly thinner, and it was noted upon about his hygiene and his lack of maintenance and personal grooming.
Gross.
Of that particular body. It's like
because he's spending more and more time in the Avatar, and the other body's a bit pointless.
Well, yeah.
So it's the following morning, and all the scientists, including Grace, are focused on everything Jake has to say. Even the military and corporate reps have warmed to Jake, as he has described that Home Tree sits atop a massive deposit of unobtainium.
Oh, they knew that already, didn't they?
I don't know if they knew it was... Oh, yeah, they may have done, actually. So, yeah, Home Tree sits atop a massive deposit of unobtainium, and Jake appears to be the best shot at convincing the tribe to move, or advising the colonel how to force them to do so. He's informed that he has 3 months to achieve his objectives before the bulldozers arrive.
Really, though? They give him 3 months for this? Given what seems to be at stake and the military might that they have and how important this unobtainium seems to be to them, they're giving him 3 months to just kind of negotiate? No.
Well, no, because he's got to earn their trust, and trust takes time to earn.
They would not bother with that. They'd be like, right, you've got 3 days.
Yes.
Tops.
Well, it might simply be that it's going to take 3 months for the bulldozers to get there.
That's fair.
I thought that was why he had 3 months, because that was literally how long it would take for the bulldozers to get there.
Okay, I buy that.
So the next few scenes revolve around Jake's avatar training with Neytiri and also human Jake's reports on his experience via vidlog, because nothing says cliched like a man talking to a video log.
Good old narration montage garbage.
We can sort of sum it up with the, you know, he starts off being really, really clumsy and eventually suddenly masters everything.
It's just, you know, can I just for a second that
go on.
How tired I am of these stories, and it is a tale as old as time, but it's just done to the nth degree and worse in this, where you have a dude who shows up and he's an idiot and he's bumbling and he's bad at everything, and he meets a woman and she's capable and intelligent and good at everything, and somehow in the space of a montage she teaches him everything she knows and he gets better at it than she is.
Yes, can
because
we stop
he's
doing
a Mary
that,
Sue.
I would very much like if that stopped happening.
Me too.
This movie. I hate it so much.
Sally!
So with reference to the vlog, the fun fact, there are dates on that log. So the first log is dated the 19th of May, 2154.
Oh, good.
And the last one, the 24th of August, 2154. So the whole movie now takes place over a 96-day period.
Right.
96 days.
Well, that would be
It certainly
months.
Felt that long when watching it. So we see lots of montages of him training. He bonds with his dire horse.
And falls flat on his face in the mud, which is just hilarious.
So yeah, he basically tries to become familiar and sort of ingratiate himself with the Navi.
And he gets invited to become one of them, and it all culminates in this ceremony where he gets to become a real boy. Wait.
Sensing that Jake is being manipulated by Quatrich, Selfridge and the rest of the military section of the mining operation, Grace decides to move her operation out of Dodge, and she moves them to Hallelujah Mountains, a remote region of immense floating islands that are sacred to the Navi, and also rich in unobtainium.
They are literally floating.
Yeah, literally.
Like, they are.
What?
Visually
no
very interesting.
For this. It just what?
I have the explanation for you, Daisy, because it looked neat in 3D.
Yes.
I mean, ignore the whole unobtainium thing. You've got mountains that float. That's got to be useful also.
Yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, like,
maybe they should, surely they should be the investigating unobtainium. This, not just be going, so we're off to the floating mountains. Oh, okay. What?
What are the physics behind these floating mountains? Is there some sort of...
Maybe it's
is there
the
some
unobtainium.
Sort of, chemical component that makes them do this? Is this something that we can potentially, I don't know, learn from? But no, we just care about dozing in and taking a bunch of a mineral. Like, there's clearly more science to learn from on this planet that might be useful.
But Grace wants to move her turf away from the officials and the military types at the base. But that's who she works for. She's not an independent contractor. So, again, this doesn't make any sense. It's like science versus military, but they both work for the same bosses.
But they both have different agendas.
Doesn't
matter.
Boss,
they still work
yeah.
for the same people.
Yeah, but you've all had that at work when, we're all working for the same company, but actually two people are really trying to achieve completely different aims.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So we have more montages, more scenes of Jake continuing to train with Neytiri. We see him sort of killing a creature in the forest and then praying for its body, which apparently is a big thing. And Neytiri says he's ready for an important rite of passage, which is him to bond and ride a Declan.
And then we watch the movie How to Train Your Dragon.
Boy, do I wish we had.
I'm not quite sure why he's ready to bond and ride with an Irishman, but there you go.
I totally missed the names of all of these things. I was just mentally calling them kaiju.
Yeah, apparently this is a Declan, which is a mountain flying sort of...
dragon.
It's a dragon.
Dragon
basically,
banshee
it's
thing.
It's a green dragon.
Yeah. It's a small dragon, which will have looked amazing in 3D.
Exactly.
I don't remember.
Yeah. This is a dangerous lesson, but Jack's lack of fear and successful bond with his banshee earn him the grudging respect of the Navi warriors present, even Susie, because, you know, he can do everything. He makes the bond with his tendrils in his queue as he rides the flying animal. He remarks he's not much of a horseman, but he was born to do this.
Oh, because at the beginning of the film, he was like, I've been having dreams about flying. And oh, look, now he's flying. And it's just also natural.
Yep.
Jake, Neytiri and the others ride together to the Tree of Souls, the most sacred place of the Navi. So obviously they leave a foreigner there to show him where it is. While out on a hunting sortie, Jake and Neytiri are suddenly pursued and attacked by a creature known to the Navi as Turok, not the dinosaur hunter.
It was about this point in the film where my motion sickness really started to kick in.
It was awful. Yeah. It was awful. It's not pleasant. It's a lot of it is very pretty, but a lot of it isn't very pleasant to watch, I find. As someone who also gets motion sickness, it was not an enjoyable experience.
Did it affect you in 2D and the 3D? Or
no, the 3D at the cinema, I think, because I was more immersed in it, that I was fine. But at home, then I'm not expecting that.
You know, speaking of immersion, I think I don't remember this being the case specifically for Avatar, but I think I went and saw one other 3D movie, and my experience of 3D cinema is basically me constantly sort of like taking the glasses off and putting the glasses on to see what it looks like without the glasses and trying to figure out, trying to predict like, I bet they're going to make that go 3D, and that, and it draws me out of the story because I'm paying more attention to sort of the special effects than I am to the actual narrative.
Yeah, I do that every time I watch a 3D film.
I don't. I just immerse myself fully.
I try and avoid 3D films at all costs.
I think the one thing that might appeal to me in terms of 3D films is in terms of what's pretty and what looks interesting here is something that's less sort of narrative driven as an actual movie and more, a really high quality filmed nature documentary. Because
I still prefer going to like the science museums, IMAX for their films in 3D, and they're amazing.
See, I think that's
much shorter.
That's a much more interesting use of 3D to me than, something like, I don't know, Avatar.
This garbage.
Paddington Bear in 3D. I don't need it.
I'd still rather watch Paddington Bear in 3D than this film in 2D.
Yeah.
While flying on a hunting sortie, Jake and Neytiri are suddenly pursued and attacked by a creature known to the Navi as Turok.
Oh yes, this is their legend.
A giant and brightly coloured flying mountain banshee with murderous intentions towards anything that flies. I'm not quite sure why it's murderous. I'm sure it's just killing to eat.
Yeah, it's surviving.
That's what it does. Neytiri says its name means last shadow. The shadow being one that when last seen, it's the last thing anybody ever gets to see.
Oh, what an inventive name.
Because its attack is almost
very
always fatal. Back at home, Neytiri shows Jake the skeleton of a precursor to the present Turok. She tells him the last person to ride a Turok was her grandfather's grandfather, who used the animal to unite the five tribes.
And we all knew at
this
point,
of great sorrow.
Because this is a white savior complex movie, we all knew that this guy would be riding that thing by the end.
Such a person would earn the title Turok Mato, rider of the last shadow. I mean, come on, he could have just had it in like fluorescent lighting around it saying
literally,
this will be you.
It feels like James Cameron is reaching out in 3D from the like movie screen and punching you in the face with a fist made entirely out of ham.
When Jake comes back to his human form, it's clear that he's been changed by his latest experience. For he says, out there is the real world,
here is
the dream.
Jeez.
The colonel comes over to him to tell him his mission is accomplished and he returned to Earth that day.
I have a fun fact here. Mm-hmm. This is where we actually see Jake's legs for the first time. And as you might be able to guess, they were not actually Sam Worthington's real legs. They were actually legs that were cast from the legs of a real paraplegic and then made into like prosthetic silicon legs for him, and his legs were kind of tucked inside the wheelchair.
Wow.
Mm.
But we've seen his legs.
No, we've just seen him underneath covers of things of him lifting the legs, underneath or underneath clothes or underneath
clothes. Right, gotcha. Yeah.
So you can't see the actual legs.
So Colonel says his mission's complete and he can return to Earth.
And he got him his legs.
Good to his word. The Colonel has arranged for Jake to get the treatment he needs to regain use of his legs. However, Jake wishes to delay his departure because he says he's right at the point in which he's to be initiated into the tribe and to be accepted as one of them, and then would have the status to negotiate with the Navi to relocate. The Colonel acquiesces, I guess because it'll save him some men and equipment. Jake attends the Navi ceremony where he learns the Navi believe that every person can be born twice. Convenient. Yeah. Neytiri leads Jake to a place of prayer, a tree of voices, where they use their cues to bond with the tree.
And each other.
Yeah, Neytiri tells Jake he can make a bow from the tree and that he can choose a woman. Jake tells Neytiri that he's already chosen her. And she says that she's chosen him.
And then they do a sex scene.
I mean, this is a choice thing, but equally, I don't know how many other women he's interacted in that tribe.
No, because she names a lot of women.
But there's only one named character that we've seen him interact with, really, apart from, like,
yeah, she's like, this
mom.
Person you've never heard of is good at this thing, and this other one you've never heard of is good at this thing.
Yeah, she's like name-dropping for us to acknowledge the fact that there are more than one female character that exists in this tribe.
Yeah,
it's not her mum.
They may be blue, but they're not Smurfs.
Yeah.
He's chosen her, she's chosen him, so they sleep together under the tree.
And it's weird.
With their ponytails.
And it's
do
weird.
Ponytail things.
And now they are
and then
naked
Jake wakes
for
back
life.
Up in the lab.
The ponytail thing is such an essential sort of like piece of physiology for these people. To have it in such a vulnerable place is really stupid.
Yeah.
Like how easy would that be for that just to get like, you know, sort of
snagged on a bush and
stepped on or, you know, damaged in some way. It's right out there. I don't care about my hair being out there if I put up a ponytail because like it's dead. I don't communicate with animals with my hair. But
I did spend a great deal of the movie wondering why the military people didn't just grab them by that and chop it off.
Yeah.
It's the morning and Neytiri wakes to the falling trees and the presence of bulldozers. Soldiers are advancing on the forest as the forest falls.
And Jake isn't in the Avatar.
Forest falls around Neytiri, who is dragging and carrying Jake to safety. When he finally revives, or rather when he gets back into the Avatar, Jake climbs onto one of the bulldozers and tries to stop it, eventually blinding its camera system and drawing some gunfire. I'm not quite sure why blinding the bulldozer was anything other than stopping the people watching him from, you know, externally. But apparently, you know, take a camera out and everything's fine.
They were controlling it remotely.
Were they?
Well, I thought they were.
Well, they were definitely watching it remotely, but I don't see any reason why it needs to be controlled remotely.
I thought it was being controlled remotely, because why would you put your humans out there if you didn't need to?
Yeah, I thought it was too.
Well,
I wasn't sure.
Which I think...
So by blinding it, he was stopping them being able to
use it. Well, given how divided we are, it's clearly not clear from the movie which is the case.
Yeah.
The Colonel, reviewing the films back at base, recognises Jake in his avatar form as the person who tries to stop their mission. The bulldozers continue their operation, though, and wipe out the sacred ground. At the home tree, the Navi want war, which I think is fair.
Yeah.
Jake and Grace argue against it. There's an intense debate. Shute tries to kill Jake, having learned that Jake and Neytiri are mated for life, because he's jealous because he was supposed to be hers.
Kind of reasonable, though.
Jake declares he is a Navi and deserves the right to speak. Suddenly, both Jake and Grace's avatars fall unconscious as the links between them and their human forms abruptly are broken by the enraged Colonel. Jake and Grace face off with the RDA and military brass. Grace reveals that Pandora's trees form a network that has more neural connections than exist in the human brain, and that Navi can tap into that network. Consequently, they will never leave Home Tree. Which, you know, have they just found that out? Because, you know, that would have been useful to know.
To be fair, pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Parker and the Colonel discuss options and decide to gas the Navi out, and then turn gunships on the Home Tree. Jake presses to be allowed to return to the tribe to try and convince them to leave, and he is granted 1 hour to achieve that objective for no apparent reason. They're not going to leave. They've just said they will never leave. And yet they're letting him back in his avatar body and not just leaving him locked up somewhere.
Well, because they have control over his human body, so it's not like he can do much. They can just pull him out again. Though how he didn't get brain damage, I do not know.
Grace and Jake are not welcome back. Neytiri rejects Jake and everybody cries. Both Jake and Grace are left bound by the tribe who are preparing to fight against the humans who have arrived in a large fleet of flying ships. This is the point in the film that I was really annoyed at for different reasons.
I was going to say, because this was the only point in the film where you're annoyed. Wow.
The reason I was annoyed by this is the bit that was in the trailer. And the trailer for the film made it look like this was another James Cameron Aliens type film. A lot of the military hardware in this is very reminiscent to what in the Aliens film, which admittedly just future versions of kind of what we've got now. And that a lot of the trailer was concentrated on the fact that this attack happens and that there's lots of battle happening, which in the full scope of the film really isn't the case. The film itself is 3.5 years long or whatever it is. And this part is a very small portion of it, but the trailer really pushed this as the main focus of the film. So when I actually watched the film, it was like, God, this isn't what I was promised. The fleet launches gas canisters into Hometree and the surrounding area.
I've got a fun fact.
Yeah?
The radio communications, as we see the Dragon gunship come onto screen, is James Cameron on the radio. It's a director cameo in voice only.
There you go.
That is your fun fact for this scene.
Thank you, Daisy.
Wow.
As I said, the fleet launches gas canisters into Hometree and the surrounding area. As the battle escalates, more of the weaponry is targeted at the root structure of Hometree, which is toppled by a series of explosions and heavy artillery.
It's a really big tree. I didn't really gauge the size of the tree until it fell.
Many of the tribe are killed. Moat frees Jake and Grace and asks them to save the tribe, because obviously they can't do it themselves. Jake arrives and... Jake arrives and is rejected again by Neytiri when he tries to console her. Neytiri's father is killed by a large piece of shrapnel. His dying wish is for Neytiri to take his sacred bow and assumes leadership of their people. The destruction seems endless, and suddenly, Jake and Grace return to their human bodies and are promptly placed under arrest for treason. Although, I don't know how they can be placed under arrest for treason, because treason is a...
against the crown.
The crown, and there is no crown, it's just corporation. Yeah. That might just be what's written here, as opposed to what actually they are charged with. Norm is also arrested for trying to prevent the soldiers from disabling their avatar forms.
Oh yeah, Norm is kind of epic here, and he totally punches out a soldier, even though he's like a will-o'-the-wisp type person. I really like Norm.
Some time has passed, and the Hometree having fallen, the Na'vi gather at the Tree of Souls.
The Na'vi have rescued Grace's avatar, which I think was very nice of them.
Trudy arrives at the cells which hold Jake, Grace and Norm. She dupes the guards by saying she wants nothing to do with them, only to knock out the guards an instant later, because we didn't see that coming.
She is a good thing about this film. A good thing.
As they prepare to flee base, Grace is shot and wounded by the colonel.
She is all the stoic.
And again, this is just like... I was getting really frustrated by this film at this point. I know this is...
You started off, like, highly frustrated and it only went up from there.
It just got progressively worse.
They fly Trudy's ship to a remote lab in the floating mountains, where Jake returns to his avatar body. I mean, did they not know where this was? Is this a case of they moved their camp and didn't tell anybody else and there's no way to track them with all their military gizmos?
Well, no, because they took them to they had basically transported the trailer... And they put it in a place where the radar interfering and obtainium meant that they couldn't be tracked.
It was like a vortex thing where the tracking doesn't work. You can only track through the visual line of sight thing.
Yeah, which was explained when they went to the floating mountains in the first place.
Jake is still an outcast, so he realises to regain the trust of the Na'vi, he has to take things to a higher level. So he sets off to find the Torok.
Of course.
Yep.
Jake believes that the Torok never looks for an attack from above himself and thus can be approached from above.
Which makes no sense
either. Ever thought
That's of so
this.
Stupid.
Yeah.
But he's White Saviour, so it will work for him.
He's the chosen.
Jake jumps off his banshee and onto the back of the Torok. I don't know whether this means that the other banshee basically is abandoned or... You know, is the banshee jealous?
Yeah, I wondered that too, what happens to
like
that
horse.
Next, we see him arriving, riding the Torok into the Tree of Souls in the middle of a tribe ceremony. Jake has successfully bonded with the Torok. Didn't see that happening. However, the tribe are stunned to see their greatest legend come true. Oh, God, this is just...
They could just go, yeah, go away, Jake, you betrayed us. But instead, they're like, oh, he's on the thing, so therefore
it's
we like
sign.
Him again. What?
It's a sign.
It's So
a quiet sobbing going on there.
I'm sorry.
Jake convinces Mark to help Grace, who is dying. Mark begins preparations which involve getting Grace's human body and Avatar's bodies in place at the Tree of Souls.
Somehow they have a ceremony.
How do they
this,
know that this is a thing that is possible? How?
Yeah.
Why would you even
guess that? The idea is to permanently transfer Grace. Grace is transferring a consciousness into her Avatar. But as you said, these are both completely alien entities. Yeah. The Avatar is manufactured. There's nothing to say this would work, or even they know this would work.
Everything's connected.
Because
it doesn't work
because
Grace doesn't believe.
Moet lets you know that Grace must pass through the Eye of Ever, and that the Great Mother might choose to let her pass through her Avatar self, or she might opt to have Grace remain with her. In other words, Moet saying it might not work. The ritual is not successful, though. Before she dies, Grace tells Jake that she has seen Ewa. Jake, whatever.
She's connected. It's beautiful.
Oh, she was a skeptic,
and now she's been
And then she does
converted.
Do a die.
Jake, heartbroken and furious, speaks as Torak Mato and says it's time to send a message to the Sky People that this is their, the Navi's land. Well, yeah, but he's still a Sky person.
He doesn't. This is what's telling us that he doesn't think of himself as a human being anymore.
But to do so, they must first go to each of the Navi clans, ask them to come and fight as one.
Cue montage of a non-stop moving camera of non-stop going to all the different tribes.
Yay!
Yep.
Barf-inducing.
The human military have picked up the infusion of Navi into the area, even though they couldn't find things like metal or other things because of the vortex. From a few hundred to 2,000 within a day. At this rate, the colonel says, as he addresses his troops, the Navi will soon total 20,000. Well done for the maths there. At which point their perimeter will be overrun. Rather than let that happen, he continues, they must stage a preemptive attack while they still can. The plan is to turn a space shuttle into a carrier of a massive bomb. Their target is the Tree of Souls, and the attack is planned for 0600 the next day.
Why didn't they just do that 6 years ago?
And none of the military personnel, who are all blatantly well-trained and well-organized, go, why are we doing this again? What have you done? Why are you in control? Because, you know, it's like they're all a bunch of non-thinking sheep.
It's how they've been trained to be.
But no, military people aren't trained to be non-thinking. They're meant to follow orders, but they're also supposed to have their own sort of common sense.
These are ex-military, so they've been trained to be non-thinking and just do what they're told by the company.
Or are they ex-military because they got fired because they were bad at it?
Yeah.
Yeah, quite possibly. Jake is busy rallying the tribes. At the Tree of Souls, he asks Ewa to look into Grace's memories and stresses that humankind killed their mother, or Earth. Ishiri arrives and tells Jake that Ewa does not take sides. Yeah, right.
Yep.
The story jumps to the final battle. Hurrah!
Finally.
The military forces are close and the bomb ship is moving towards the Tree of Souls. The United Navi force begins to arrive from the sky and on the ground.
I have a fun fact about the final battle.
What? The fact that it's final is a good fact.
That's a good fact, yes. Neytiri, she has a white handprint on her chest as part of her war paint, and it has 5 fingers on it, so that means that it must be Jake's hand.
Oh.
Jake been feeling up.
She was an Orokai.
Yeah, she's an Orokai, one of the two. So there's a battle.
Yeah, the helicopters look like
casualties mount on both sides. Yeah,
they wait with dragons.
It's kind of it's bows and arrows against the lightning. It's just it's one of those where you watch it and you don't really know what's going on because it's just all over the place.
Yeah. I couldn't actually tell you what happened at this point.
It's a terrible blur.
No, I struggled as well. Jake, riding in the Torak, is pursued and shot at by Colonel Quattridge's ship. Trudy arrives and open fires on the Colonel's command ship. Neytiri's Banshee is shot down and killed. Norm's Avatar is mortally wounded and jumps in his human form. Susei takes on the bomb ship and is killed in the attempt. Trudy dies when her ship is blown up. And this is all note forms, but to be honest, none of it has any real impact. Even Trudy dying, which is one of the characters we really liked, is given no time at all. Other than the fact that Jake then goes, hello, is anybody there? There's no real sort of...
Yeah, she was fighting in the helicopter. She took their own equipment and was using it against them because that's how awesome she was. And then, we didn't really get to feel anything about her death.
No, nothing at all. Meanwhile, the bomb ship closes on the Tree of Souls. Jake tells Neytiri via communicator to disengage from the fight. But suddenly, through what's left of the surrounding forest, a battalion of what we classed as rhino dinosaurs arrive and engage the Earth forces. Because apparently Uwa does take sides.
And she knows how to
organize. At least when
it's
suited to the plot.
Dinosaurs better than mechs.
Stupid question. How did they get communicators?
I assume they were on the ship that they stole when they flew there. But no, I agree. Oh, well, they might actually have been in the mobile lab as well. But that's not a stupid question, not compared to quite a few of them in this thing.
That's not a stupid question because we're just having to guess that, which means that they didn't tell us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wondered whether it was some kind of psychic Navi sense, sort of like a, hey, listen, type situation.
Could be, but I think they were sort of shown as neck, sort of mounted communicators. So.
Yeah, I figured that they had some kind of, I thought it was around their necks, the communicator.
Jake and his Turok take to the sky to confront the bomb ship as the military's ground forces retreat in disarray. Approaching from above, Jake grenades the bomb ship and it crashes in flames and explodes well away from the Tree of Souls. Jake also throws explosives into vulnerable parts of the command ship. It begins to burn and go down. As it does so, Colonel Quattridge puts on his AMP suit, which is sort of a small mech type thing that we've seen a few times but never really explained.
Yes, but the fact that they showed us it earlier in the film means that you know it's going to be important later in the film.
Yeah.
But the one thing here that really annoyed me, out of the many, many things that really annoyed me, was this whole atmosphere is not breathable. But this dude can hold his breath like an Olympic swimmer. And I swear he went, ha, at Jake, and then proceeded to, you know, trottle along to get in his mech. And it's like, dude, you should be gasping on the floor.
Maybe they were exaggerating before when they were saying 20 seconds and 4 minutes.
It is literally one of those where it's convenient for the plot until it's not convenient, so therefore, you know, you just ignore it at that point.
It was just so annoying.
Because they have.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't even stay consistent with their own rules.
The Colonel puts on his AMP suit, which is kind of like a slightly positive version of the lifter from Aliens, and jumps free of the command ship before it disintegrates in a ball of flames. He makes his way to the temporary camp set up by Grace and the others when they moved operations away from the base. Human Jake, of course, is inside the camp and linked to his avatar.
Completely helpless.
Quattridge, set on killing Jake, is now attacked by a Thanator, which apparently is the sort of cat-like native animal that chased Jake over the waterfall. Being ridden by Neytiri, because she's bonded with the animal.
Of course,
because she's awesome.
Because she's awesome,
she is. Which just begs the question, why don't they always bond with them? Why do they bond with the horses and that? It seems like they're just...
Well, because you can ride a lion, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you want to do it every day, because it might bite
and
your head off.
And also dragons can fly.
It's for special times only.
That seems reasonable to me. That's one of the few things that seems reasonable in this.
With the aid of his AMP suit, the Colonel kills the Thanator, and Neytiri is trapped underneath it. Before the Colonel has a chance to kill Neytiri as well, Avatar Jake arrives. The two engage in combat, the Colonel in his AMP suit and Jake in his avatar, armed only with a piece of pipe.
Yeah, he arrives to save the day.
Jake smashes the suit's plastic canopy. The Colonel pops it off, dons a breathing mask and, before he moves off towards a structure that houses the pods, asks Jake how he feels to have betrayed his race. You think you're one of them, he says. Time to wake up, he taunts as he smashes into the mobile lab looking for Jake's pod, intent on destroying it and the human Jake.
Whilst Neytiri has no idea that that's the danger with what he's doing with that mobile lab, she has no idea that Jake's actual body is in there and that he can die as a result.
Battle resumes. Jake is grabbed by the arm of AMP suit and hangs from his queue before the Colonel. Meanwhile, Neytiri has almost freed herself, because it's about time for things to happen.
Like the end of the movie.
The Colonel now moves Jake closer to him and reaches for his knife, intending to finish Jake by slitting his throat, even though Jake isn't actually there.
Yeah,
that's
he'll
just
still be
avatar.
Fine in his...
Suddenly, Neytiri shoots an arrow at the Colonel that penetrates deeply into the centre of his chest. The Colonel, reeling, is unable to continue his attack on Jake. Neytiri's second arrow lodges next to his first. This brings the Colonel in the AMP suit to the ground. However, much damage has been done to the lab, which is leaking oxygen. Human Jake is awake, but having difficulty both breathing and trying to get a mask on. Neytiri arrives and helps Jake on with his mask.
Well, no, first she picks him up and goes, Jake, my Jake, and then realises that he's trying desperately to breathe and then realises there's a mask thing, I will help with this. Because she doesn't actually know.
Yeah, he hasn't explained any of this to her. That she doesn't know what he really looks like or anything. And
well, you say that, but I'm wondering whether she does, because... The Navi are obviously quite good at being not seen. They must be keeping an eye on the camp and seeing what the actual sky people look like.
Yeah.
They must know. And I mean, Gracie's been running a school. She's probably explained what's happening there as well.
But they probably don't necessarily understand about the air not being breathable.
No, that bit might not be, but...
Possibly. We don't know, I think, is a good point to make here, is that we just don't know because...
Yeah. I think that's pretty much, like, the sum.
Because they've done a crap job of explaining this to us.
Cradling human Jake, she says, "I see you." It is the first time they have seen each other face to face.
Yeah, that's the thing,
wasn't
isn't
this a tagline for the movie?
Well, I see you, or my God, this is crap.
The I see you bit, they didn't use the, oh God, it's crap, I don't know.
Well, they should have done.
No.
Yeah, it might have been more
accurate. Cut to the former military base, which is now under Navi control. Most of the remaining humans are being marched into a shuttle to be shipped back to Earth. However, a select few Earth people, such as Norm and Dr. Patel, are invited to stay on Pandora. Jake signs off in his final video log, where we learn he has chosen to transfer his consciousness to his avatar for good.
And it's his birthday!
In a ceremony similar to Grace's, Jake passes through the eye of Uwa and wakes up in his avatar with Natori watching over him.
As we all know,
the end.
If you are disabled, then in order to have a happy ending, you must finish by no longer being disabled.
Of course. What a great message!
Hollywood. You're
what
awesome.
What an amazing message.
This is the end of Avatar, which is a good thing, and there's no need for any further story. That's all. It's wrapped up. It's the end of it. There's no need for...
Never
oh, God, they're doing
they
four
make
more sequels.
Another one of these, because why would they?
Every year from 2020, they're making another... They're releasing another one.
This is just a terrible idea.
Well, you say that, but I do wonder whether they'll release more than one if it is completely and utterly a commercial failure.
I mean, if
failure.
The first one does quite badly, maybe they'll just give up.
I mean, I suspect the first one will do okay because there's a few people that are interested in it and a lot of people don't remember how bad this film is.
I've got a few more fun facts I can squeeze in at the end here.
Please do.
This movie took 4 years to make.
And 3.5 to watch, as we've already discovered.
The composer said that it was the most difficult film and biggest challenge of his career.
They always say that about everything they do, though.
He worked on the music from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. for a year and a half.
Why?
Well, that's because they didn't give him enough time to do it, clearly.
James Horner was the composer.
Oh, James Horner! Oh, he's awesome. I knew I liked the music.
He's also dead.
The movie was 40% live action and 60% CGI. Zoe Saldana was... They had her so that she was captured both facially and vocally at the same time. And then it took a year for them to transfer all of that capture to her CGI version.
Which just shows how much things have moved forward when you see Andy Serkis doing Snoke in the latest Last Jedi, and it's almost instantaneous.
Yeah. That's I've got more facts, but those are the most interesting of them. So,
well, I thought it was a visually and auditorily, music-wise, appealing film. When not seen in 3D and thus making me want to vomit.
It was a film of its time, wasn't it? Because it was really technologically stunning to audiences when it came out. But that's not the case anymore.
No.
Yeah, that's a
No, actually,
fun,
that's true. I mean, this is... We're kind of dropping into final thoughts here, but I did think that whilst watching the film is that although I can see why it would be what you'd class as technologically breakthrough when it came out, it's not aged particularly well in many ways. Some of the CGI and the facial CGI stuff really isn't great, not compared to what we have now. And the story was just...
Yeah, when
James Cameron, actually, after he saw Pocahontas back in the 90s, was when he had, shockingly, when he had the idea for this film and he wanted to make it then, but the budget and the technology just wasn't... It didn't make it feasible, so it wasn't till, you know, like, going on for 20 years later that it actually got made. And it's a shame that it did, really.
Oh, so he got he was inspired by Pocahontas?
Yeah.
Really?
Shocking.
I would not have guessed.
Shocking, shocking, isn't it? Yeah.
It's as though these alien creatures which bear no resemblance to anything on Earth aren't, like, an obvious stand-in for, like, every native peoples in anywhere.
Though it really does a good way of showing that no means no. And if you go into somewhere and they say, no, we're not interested in learning your thing, and no, you can't have our precious minerals and force us out of our home, that you really should just take no for an answer, because otherwise you're just going to end up dead or sent home with your tail between your legs.
Yeah, but then you can come back 6 years later, which I suspect is what the next film is. Okay, so let's do some final thoughts then, although I think we have espoused our love of this film quite a lot at the moment. Sammy, do you want to go first with your final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Look, I've talked about the, and we've talked about the whole, like, white, you know, sort of like Western dude comes in to, you know, this, you know, sort of like special other place and somehow manages to be the most special person there and yada yada yada. But I also want to talk about like the natives in this film being like, you know, sort of the, but well, not the aliens because it's their planet, but but you know, is the obvious stand-ins for native peoples. And kind of what's going on here is something that also really, really bothers me, is when you take, you know, sort of a group of like non, you know, it's like a Western white filmmaker and take a group of like non-Western white people and just sort of, you know, be like, look at how great they are and everything they do is so wonderful because their technology isn't advanced and they're so noble. And it's like, you know what? That's still racist though. Okay?
Yeah.
Because you're just using this ridiculous fetishizing essentialist view of these people as inherently just, you know, noble because they don't have our Western whatevers, and just using them as like a device to help us be better people and learn about ourselves. And that's a crappy treatment of people too, because you're not treating them as like a three-dimensional, you know, sort of society. And I realize that this is a fictional society, but it has obvious parallels to actual Earth-based people that it was based on, that from that standpoint it just feels so racist to me and it really makes me angry.
Yeah,
and that's the whole but I mean, not just that, but the writing of this movie is just so bad. It's just the message that they're getting across, they're just bashing you over the head with it. There's no subtlety. The Earth people, which, you know, standing in for basically like white Western American military people, are just, they're not even, there's no subtlety to their motivations or their character, you know, like the bat, he might as well be twirling a freaking mustache. He's so obviously just evil from the get-go. There's no subtlety. There's no grayness to anything that happens in this film. It's just these people are bad and these people are good, and Jake gets to be one of them because he's the special white guy. It's just garbage. Everything about this movie is just bad, and I really struggle. I struggle to let the visuals make me, you know, I can't even really like the prettiness of it because the story is such a pile of crap. And I hate it, and I hate that I had to watch this again, and I hate that so many people watched it that it was the highest grossing movie of that year, because I am sure that there are so many other movies that deserve that.
It broke records for the highest grossing ever in the history of ever at that time as well.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
But I hate you.
Yeah.
Daisy, final thoughts?
I felt like this film was made purely for the visuals, which is then completely lost on a home cinema, and that the plot is basically like a bad NaNoWriMo novel. That's National Novel Writing Month, where you write a 50,000-word novel in a month. I think that this is like a you know, there are many NaNo novels that are good. This felt like a bad one, that was just purely, oh, how can we find a reason to have these stunning visuals that will only ever work the first time in a cinema. I don't plan to ever watch this again.
Yeah.
No, I think that's fair enough. And Joe, final thoughts?
Well, I remember this film being, or not being very impressed by this film when I saw it at the cinema. So I tried to go into watching it with an open mind because I'm like, surely it can't be quite as bad as I remember. And it wasn't, but it was, if you see what I mean. I actually really liked the visuals purely because it was, what's the word? It was a war movie, but it wasn't dark and gritty. It was green and blue and pretty. So that was, it was just a nice change, to be perfectly honest. And the music was lovely, but then I liked James Horner's music. I mean, okay, yeah, it's dated. But I actually disagree with the fact that it didn't look as good as it did in 3D. I actually thought it looked fine. I've seen it twice now. No, twice in the last 3 weeks. I was expecting there to be sort of overly long sequences that were, that would look good in 3D, but not so much in 2D. But I watched it on my 4K TV and it looked pretty good. I didn't actually notice the fact that the camera was continuously moving when people were speaking. So obviously that didn't bother me, which is quite cool, because I would not have wanted to be nauseated watching this.
Yeah, I'm sorry if on a rewatch you now notice that.
Well, I don't ever plan to watch it again. I've watched it three times now, once in its original intended format and twice in the last 3 weeks. So that's it.
Never again. That's, I think, a good plan.
And I mean, James Cameron, I didn't really dislike Titanic. I didn't really dislike this movie. The plot made me very angry, but the movie itself was okay. Like, the technical part of the movie itself was okay. But yeah, I spent a lot of time going, why do you think you have the right to come in here to a planet where you can't even breathe and everything's trying to eat you, to take something that isn't yours just because you feel you have a right to it? And yeah, that was just...
I think the movie is trying to tell us that that's the wrong attitude, but yeah. But just in such, it's just in such an obvious way. That's the thing for me, is that it's just in such an, it's so obvious. There's no
subtlety.
It's
like at the end of the cartoons when you're a kid and it was let's talk about the moral movie.
Is G.I. Joe at the very end of the G.I. Joe cartoon show coming on and being like, you know, always remember to recycle. Or wear your bicycle helmet or whatever. Yeah,
my old She-Ra
and My Little Pony.
A little bit at the end, and be like, "Oh wow, here is my moral lesson. Thank you."
Yeah, and that's not subtle because it's aimed at kids, whereas this isn't subtle
because it's crap.
So, what about your final thoughts? You get to say your final thoughts this time, Dave.
My final thoughts on this film are: it is, yeah, I. It looks good. Technically, for its time, it was very good. I can see why it's popular because of the 3D. I'm sure watching it in 3D would have changed my opinion of it slightly, possibly, but only in the visuals, not in the storytelling, which was terrible. And someone just needs to tell James Cameron to stop.
I think the trouble is a lot of people are telling him to stop, and he's just not listening.
The fact that he's making four more of these Avatar films is just almost soul crushing.
Someone somewhere has signed that off. Did they not watch this film?
I suspect that it made so much money that no one needed to sign it off. He's financing it all himself.
The people of Hollywood just need to stage an intervention. You know, he thinks he's coming around for, like, you know, a raclette party, and he's going to have some nice melty cheese and gherkins and stuff. And he shows up, and all of his friends are just gathered around very solemnly, and they're like, James, we need to talk about Avatar.
With a little banner behind that says Avatar Intervention. Mm-hmm.
That which is probably the title of the third film, so there we go. So yes, that is Avatar, 2009's highest grossing film for some reason. The next film in our regular scheduling is Going My Way, which is a 1944 musical, which I, and I believe most of us here, will know absolutely nothing about. I've got a feeling it might even be a sequel to something, but I don't know.
Daisy will know.
Or perhaps there's something.
I don't know.
Perhaps there's something else on this list is a sequel to that. I'm not sure. But yes, that is Going My Way, which will be an experience for all of us, because, well, it's not Avatar. But until then, thank you for listening to us waffle on about this film. Thank you to my fellow podcasters. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you, I guess.
And thank you, Sammy.
God, that's over.
For making us go.
I agree entirely.
A kind of thank you.
Yeah. I am so sorry. I am sorry, so sorry. Until next time, I'd like to, as I said, thank you all for listening, and we will see you all. Well, we won't see you because we can't see you. Apart from you,
yes,
we are watching you.
Your hair looks amazing today.
Yeah, we're definitely
watching you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and stop that. Don't do that in public.
You'll go blind.
Honestly.
Yeah. Until next time, thank you all for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing network. Visit us at www.thatpodcastthing.co.uk, where you can find links to all our social media, including Twitter, Facebook, and our new YouTube channel. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon. Of course, that is the golden rule of the HMC podcast. Don't stop recording.